good to be here. I was talking to these guys earlier, and we kind of agreed that we kind of feel like Madonna's seventh husband on his wedding night. We know what needs to be done, we just don't know how to make it interesting. Is that right? Tom's not here, is he? That's it. Well, it's great to be here. Dwight and George are going to lay it on us this morning, but Steve and Dean told me they wanted me to share a little bit, and I've had a couple of different things happen to me in the last couple of weeks, and it kind of falls along with the family illness. It's been 2 weeks ago. I got a call like 4:30 in the evening and asked me to come to a deal called Parents Helping Parents. I'd never heard of it. I had no idea what it was. But I agreed to go, and I got down there and went into a room. There was about 35 people, and most of them couples. And you talk about doom and gloom. Those people were absolutely wiped out. And they were parents and grandparents of kids who have or incarcerated or in treatment or out on the streets or what have you. And as I kind of looked around there, I realized what the problem was is those guys come together and they just talk about their problems with no solution. And so what happened was I had two young people with me. One girl had about a year, another young man had about 2 years, and they started it out. And I could tell that those people were hooked in and so thirsty for a solution to something that they were all about, you know, listening to a solution of Alcoholics Anonymous. And what I saw happen was Alcoholics Anonymous in action. You know, in a matter of an hour, we turned that room totally around. And when that thing was over, they wouldn't let us go. They had us cornered up. There was laughter. There was people hugging. It was an amazing demonstration of a message of hope. I thought BJ brought a tremendous message last night of hope, and I think that is the message that Alcoholics Anonymous brings forward, is there is hope. This 2 weeks ago, it'd be 3 weeks now, this coming Tuesday, I got a phone call that none of us want. And to back up just a little bit, about 12 years ago, I worked with a young man, very, very young, 17 years old, got in a little trouble, ended up in Alcoholics Anonymous, worked with him briefly. For whatever reason, he didn't stay with us. And 2 years after he left, his twin brother showed up in Alcoholics Anonymous, and I've sponsored him for 8 years now. 3 weeks ago, he called me on a Tuesday afternoon, and he is absolutely out of his mind, screaming and bawling and what have you. And I said, you know, settle down and tell me what's going on. You've got to tell me what's going on. Well, his twin brother had killed his wife and 16-month-old daughter and then shot himself. Now that's the worst of the worst. I just absolutely. But what happened was, is this young man that I sponsor was able to go to his family, and he was the pillar the entire family has leaned on and been. And that's why we get sober, you know. So when those types of things, hopefully they'll never happen. But if something like that does come about, you know, the principles and the 12 steps of Alcoholics Anonymous afford us an opportunity to be of service to the people that we damaged and hurt so much. When I think about, there's somewhere in our literature talks about more will be revealed, and I think for what that means to me is that as time goes on, the depth of my selfishness and self-centeredness constantly comes to me. Just a little bit lower level. You know, I thought I did a decent job of when I did an inventory and all that kind of stuff, but as time goes on and I continue that inventory process, what I realize is that the magnitude of my selfishness and self-centeredness is unbelievable. It's not measurable. And, you know, thank God, I think we're the luckiest people in the world. You know, lots of people go through this world and never have that opportunity to do that inventory and kind of understand why that we have such a hard time with life. You know, when Bill Wilson was in Towns Hospital, Ebby brought him a book, Varieties of Religious Experiences by William James. And if you've ever tried to read that, you need about a PhD to really get into it, you know. It's a little bit heavy for this country boy, I'll tell you for sure. But Bill was able to read that while he was still in Towns Hospital, and the way his mind worked, as I vision it, was that he read all those case histories, and what he came out of that was all those people who were not necessarily alcoholics or addicts or what have you. They were people that just absolutely crushed by life. And Bill read all those case histories, and what he found was that all those people had three things in common: great pain and suffering, complete deflation, and a cry out for help. And I think that's where our three pertinent ideas, I believe, come from. I don't know that. It just seems to me like that's a natural thing. The damage, and I think I talked about this last year, but of all the terrible, terrible things that I did, and I trust me, I did them on a daily basis. My dad died when I was 8 years old as a result of an injury he received overseas on a job. And they sent him stateside. He was sick for months and months and months and finally eventually died. No woman ever loved a man more than my mother loved my daddy. And I can remember going to her house, and I said, "Mom, I need $100. And I told her this lie that I had a job, that I needed a little money just to kind of get me by until the job, I could get a payday. She knew it was a lie. I knew it was a lie, you know. But she said, "Well, honey, I'm going to Al-Anon." And she says, "Those ladies down there just tell me that I can't give you any more money." I didn't know what Al-Anon was, but I knew it had a lot to do with my cash flow. But what I told that woman next had to be one of the most horrible things that a human being could possibly do to their mother. And what I said was, "If you don't give me that $100, I'm going to take that overseas job where they'll pay me a bonus." See, I reached into her heart and I grabbed it and I squeezed it and I turned it and I jerked it right out. And I'll never forget, if I live to be 100, her writing that check out and that tear landing on that check and that ink running all over it. And see, I was so far down in that thing that I didn't allow her the dignity to take that thing to the grocery store or somewhere and cash it. I took it to a beer joint and cashed it there, just confirming what she already knew. You know, thank God, you know, I was 28 years sober when she passed away. I was 14 years sober when my dad passed away. And what happened as a result of Alcoholics Anonymous, I got the mom and dad that I always wanted, and they got the son that they always wanted. I was with both of them when they left this world. It was a powerful, powerful thing to know that when they left here, everything had been said and everything had been done, and I was able to let them go. You know, my heart went out to BJ last night when he was talking about his dad and thinking about how horrible that would be to be still in the cups when that thing happens. It's millions and millions of things to be grateful for, but more than anything, I think my relationship with my family and those very close to me is where it ought to be as a direct result of Alcoholics Anonymous. I appreciate you all, and I thank George. Were you the one that didn't show up last year? No, it's that one. I wasn't going to bring that up. It just slipped out. I got stuck up here by myself for an hour last year, you know. They hadn't healed up yet, so. George, you want to come get it?
Sure.
All right.
Good morning, everybody. My name is George Jones, no relation to the other one, and I am an alcoholic. My sobriety date is October 31st of 2002. I'm a member of the Primary Purpose Group of Wilson. Never thought I'd be saying that. The principals will keep looking at me like, wow. Joe, I want to thank you for saying that again. Me and my girlfriend listened to you coming down the highway last night, and it just opened up a lot of doors that I guess I had closed subconsciously, because, I mean, no alcoholic sober today wants to think about that stuff, but they need to. At least I need to, just like I need to remember that I'm an alcoholic, because I don't ever want to put my family through what I put them through. If they could see me now. We talk about alcoholism being a family illness, and I guess the denial of the illness while I was drinking 30 plus years, I never saw that, because the line that would always come out of my mouth is, it's my money, I'm the only one hurting me, the only problem is you guys keep messing with my drink and leave me alone. You know, I had blinders on. You know, you ever see the... Heck of an analogy. The Budweiser Clydesdales, their blinders are like this. Mine were like this. I was born and raised in New York City, Staten Island. My mother's from, I got one. I should have known with the Giants hat on. Go Giants, Mark. I'm done. I'm in trouble now. I have to behave. I was okay. I looked at Dwight. I looked at Joe. I looked at Dean, and everything was good. And then Tom, I walked in a room, and you know, now I'm nervous all over again. He just has that effect when he comes into the room. Growing up in my house, I guess alcohol was a socially acceptable. What I remember about my dad is a Marine. To this day, at 70 years old. But he never said, I love you. He was a disciplinarian. I'm sure Rick in the room can relate to that. But he showed his love by doing what he did for the family. He paid the bills. He kept the roof over our head. He kept clothes on our back. And he made sure we stayed in school. And I have the marks on my body to this day to prove that he was a disciplinarian. But what I remember about my dad, he didn't talk much during the week, but on the weekend we had, back then, some of you guys in here are probably too young, you know, like Tom's, remember those little mini bars they had? And my dad had one of those in the corner. And even as a child, I was curious, like the name, George. I was an observer by nature, you know, and I used to watch him during the week. And I don't think I respected my dad. I probably feared him more than I respected him. But when I saw him drink, it just kind of changed his personality. You know, he would open up. I could even get some money out of him now. If that wasn't God back then, I don't know what was. But, of course, just like some of us in this room, no, nobody in this room has never done this. When we had the little house parties on the weekends and we go out, and when the elders would get somewhat tipsy, the little ones would go tipsin'. And stealing drinks and that whole nine yards. You know, my first good drunk was at age 12 on Christmas. I'll never forget it. Not that I remembered it at the time, but I remember it now. We went down. We were having a Christmas party at my house, and my grandparents owned the house down the street. They had just moved up from Virginia. And we went down to my uncle's house, who lived over my grandmother, and I drank a little Peel's Nip. I remember drinking that, and I remember nothing. Now, I remember my cousin went behind the counter and poured something clear into it, and the next thing I remember, I was covered with snow. When they found me, I had made it halfway back to the house. I had fell out in the snow. I had a radio, and they said I wouldn't let go of the radio. I was trying to get up making snow angels, you know. I remember my mother. See, my dad didn't talk. My mother did all the screaming, the hollering, and... You know, when my dad got involved, it's because he was tired of hearing her talk. And when he came in, just furniture started moving. That's the best way to describe it, because that's all I remember. Because I was trying to dive under it, and he was flipping stuff over trying to get me. But that didn't stop me. I remember being deathly sick, going to another party. And that just started me you know, on a long, long road. You know, I can relate to a lot of what Joe said about the, you know, the advantage that I took of my mother. Now, through everything and what you're about to hear, my mother never once gave up on me. You know, and when I gave up on me, she didn't give up on me. I mean, I did everything from steal money out of her pocketbook, steal her car when she was asleep. Habitual liar. You know, it got to the point where I started believing my own lies. I'm sure nobody in this room can identify with that either. I stayed away from my dad because he would sit back. His famous line was, "You think you're doing something new under the sun, don't you?" "What do you mean, Dad?" "You'll figure it out." See, my dad was the type that he would always say, "I'll give you enough rope to hang yourself." I didn't know what that meant until he hung me. You know, and I mean literally, because I was a runner, you know. It's something about cowhide and rawhide, what real belts used to be made out of when they were like this big and this long. When they hit you, what it would do to you, you know. And for me, when I saw it, I'd start running. So he solved that. That's why my girlfriend says, "Boy, you got some big hands." I said, "Well, if your dad made you put your hands together and lift you up in the air, your hands would be big too." But that didn't stop me. What it did was I didn't know it at the time, I developed resentment towards my dad. My mother was neutral in everything, and that's another thing I had to take a look at when I came into sobriety. The positions that I continuously placed my mom in defending me when my dad wanted to throw me out the house before I was 18. You know, I don't know anything about social drinking, and if there are any social drinkers in the room, I would kindly ask you to leave now because I do not like you. You are still on my fourth step. I haven't got past that part yet. I am a chronic alcoholic of the worst kind. I never drank for taste. I drank strictly for effect. You know, I had one gear that I tell my girlfriend now that she's an extremist. I had one gear wide open. Everybody else will go to the store and get Budweiser. I could never understand Budweiser. You know, I'm going for the hard lick. I'm going for malt lick. I'm going for something with a kick, like that can with that horse on it or the horse's head. I'm trying, Dean. I'm trying. You know, I remember the disappointing looks, you know, even as I listened to Joe coming down the highway, stuff I had forgot about. And some things I never even looked at, to be honest. It was something about listening to that tape when you're focused and no distractions, nobody talking to you because she was quiet. And I remember those looks that used to be on my mother's face, you know, and my mother used to say, "You're giving me age lines, you know, or crow's feet," or whatever you women refer to them, you know. And I started visually seeing that stuff coming down the highway, you know. My drinking did more damage to my family than I ever imagined. And you know, and the more, they say stick around, the more will be revealed. The longer I stay sober, never think you know it all, because something new always seems to come up or something will happen and it'll open up a door that you never knew existed, if you can identify with that. You know, which is a good thing for me because I really, really need to feel all of this. I guess when I was about 13 or 14, you know, I kind of gravitated away from the house. I gravitated to people who would like me, who would socially accept me. I didn't know what that was at the time, but that's what I refer to it as now. And my dad used to always say, "If you keep picking your friends over this family, you can go live with your friends." You know, and I'd sit there, you know. I wasn't quite ready to stand up to him because in my father's house, there was only going to be one man. And the day I decided I was going to be a man was the day I was going to leave. You know, my mother, I have a younger sister, a year younger than me, and I don't know what my mother was thinking about. Maybe she had her own spiritual experience, but she waited 10 years and decided to have two more kids. So I have another younger brother and sister. And at the time, I guess I was about 15 years old, and I went out somewhere, got drunk, came in the house, and I said I was going to make some hot dogs. I was going to boil some hot dogs. Now, the only problem with that is in order to boil hot dogs, you got to have water in the pan, right? I didn't have any water in the pan. I guess I thought the hot dogs were going to make their own water. I sat down at the kitchen table, and that's where I fell asleep. I remember I can laugh today, but I can assure you it wasn't funny. Now, I remember my dad snatching me up by the back of my collar, dragging me to the door, and I was coughing. The entire house was full of smoke. My mother standing on the porch in her nightgown, holding my baby brother, pregnant, crying. And my dad screaming at me, and I'm so numb, I don't know what's going on, you know. And he said, what do you have to say for yourself? And I couldn't talk. And I remember looking up at my mother, and I'm like, Ma. And she turned away from me. That's the first time. I'll never forget that. That's the first time that my mother ever turned her back on me. And she was crying, and the baby was crying. My sister was sitting there talking stuff to me, you know, and my dad said, get your stuff and get out of my house, you know. And I said, fine. You know, that illness gives you courage and stupidity. And I said, fine. Reality didn't hit me because it was the middle of January. And if you've ever been to New York in January, it's, well, it's cold. So I get out there, I'm about drunk, I get around the corner, and that cold hits me, and I sober up instantly. So drunk, the only thing I took was a pair of pants. I had no coat on, I had flip-flops on, and I had shorts on. The smart alcoholic that I am. I walked the street all that night. Now, I guess for some that might have been their bottom, but for me, that was still getting started, you know. Manipulative as I was, you know, I stayed out. I walked all night. I crept in the backyard. Only a classic alcoholic would do this because we had a dog, a Doberman. And I kicked her out of her doghouse, and I crawled in there, and that's where I slept. And she sat there all night looking at me like I was crazy, you know. The next day, my dad went to work. My mom stayed home, and I manipulated her, and she soft-soaked my dad once again and paved the way for me to come in the house with conditions. The first condition was, do not touch his liquor. Leave my liquor alone. Well, Dad, I'm not drinking your liquor. Really? Well, I had two full bottles of gin in there, and now they're two full bottles of water. How do you explain that? For those of you who haven't tried this, please don't try this. Water and gin do not have the same effect. And a good drinker will know the difference. That's what I was doing, sneaking his liquor and pouring water in there, and, you know. I was wondering what those little scratch marks on the side of the label was. I said, wow, they tear these bottles up, taking them out the box. My dad was marking the bottles. So I said, fine. I went and got a summer job, and most kids get a summer job, and they buy things, you know, bicycles, take their girlfriends out. I was buying beer and liquor. Back then, growing up in the neighborhood, you were well known. You know, I'm so glad the laws are in effect that they are today as far as serving alcohol to minors. You know, because I was known for going to the store to get alcohol from my uncles, and then when they were hanging out, they would always send me because I was always a big guy. Height-wise, I didn't start spreading this way until I got just a little bit older. You know, at age 25 now, yeah, you get it. you know, and I remember out of defiance, I ended up in the Army. By the way, another great alcoholic decision out of defiance, because I decided I was going to, I was always on this mission to live up to my dad's standards. The problem was I never knew what his standards were, you know, too blind to see it, if anything, you know. I used to always tell myself I wanted to be like him. Now, the untrue blame that I used to put on him was I started drinking because of him. My alcoholism has absolutely nothing to do with my father, and I realize that today. Because for a lot of years, he was my excuse, and I used him as a bullseye, unfairly. I can say that honestly today. My dad's not an alcoholic. He's a social drinker to this day, and he's on my fourth step for that reason. So I decided I was going to go into the service, and I wanted to go into the Marine Corps. And back then they offered what was called a split option training program for those who were still in high school, and I was barely making it. I don't know how. And my dad said, well, I told him I wanted to go into the Marines. Again, trying to prove a point. He said, I'm not sending you into the Marines. You can't handle it. And that just made me mad, sitting in the recruiter's office. Now you embarrass me too, you know. I remember looking at this picture on the wall, and I saw this soldier, the stuff that I used to watch growing up on TV, like John Wayne and those old war movies. And I saw him with that helmet on, that OD green and that M16. And boy, I said, that's what I want to do right there. And the recruiters, well, recruiters are, I guess, for another talk. But next to the devil, if they're already in this room, you next to the devil, you are the next biggest lie on the face of the earth. Because he began to sell me this story about how if you sign this contract, how you're going to travel, see the world, meet exotic women, and make a whole lot of money. Well, I'm here to tell you this. None of that happened. What did happen was I found a place where there were other drunks just like me. I signed up for an infantry unit, went to a combat unit. We spent the majority of our time out in the field, so an alcoholic would develop quite a thirst by the time he came back to base. The average drinker, the social drinker, might go buy a six-pack, and that lasts him a week, and I still haven't figured that one out yet. We would go and buy a case each to get started. Now, at age 21, I could drink a case of beer, any beer, and walk. That's not normal. Looking for something harder, and usually got it. Got into a lot of fights, got into a lot of, I don't know how I got out of the military with an honorable discharge. I guess they felt pity for me, or God stepped in, or a combination of both, because I stayed in trouble. I got confined to the base and literally dug under the fence to go into town to get a drink, and got caught coming back by gunpoint, about got shot. That would have stopped the normal person, not me. The next weekend, I'm thinking about another way to get out. They're threatening to send me to Fort Leavenworth with a mini hammer to break big rocks. And I'm still not listening to them. I think as far as rank goes, you ever see those charts like on the EKG machine when your heart's hooked up to it? It's do, do, do. That's how my rank went. Because of my drinking and towards the end of my career, it just kind of leveled out. Finally, they said, we had enough of you. I had met a young lady when I went home on leave. I got a phone call from my dad. My dad was the type, he would ask you a question and he would save you the trouble of answering it because he would answer it for you. He called me and said, oh, Olivia's here. She would like to talk to you. I said, okay, great. Hey, how you doing? She gets on the phone. She says, hi. I don't believe I'm saying this now. Anyway, maybe I told my sponsor about it. She said, hi, I'm pregnant. I said, okay. And my dad gets on the phone. He says, hey, son, how you doing? You doing good? Great. You know, this young lady is pregnant, right? What you going to do? You're going to get married, right? And all I remember saying is, yes, sir. So the next great unspiritual awakening I had, something said, you know what, I'm tired of these people telling me what to do in the military, so I'm going to get out. Now, here they are. They're willing to help me because they realize I have a problem. And they said, young man, we will offer you X amount of dollars. You can re-up. We'll give you the bonus, but you have to go see the psychologist and all this other stuff they had in place. I said, nah. And I got out. And I got married within a year, got married. And the next great decision I had was, and don't do this at home, newlyweds, do not move across the street from your parents. Especially when your parents like your wife more than you. Needless to say, everything that I did made it across the street. There were many days that I came home the next day late from work. I was just a little bit late, D, coming home the next day, broke. And my mother standing on the porch, she had taken off from work because she needed to talk to me, find out what's going on. Why is your wife over there with that baby crying? You see, I'm taking on responsibilities, yet I'm not. I'm a husband, a father. I got response. I'm not living up to none of that stuff, you know. And this is the route I took. I began to buy materialistic stuff to make up for my guilt and my shame. You know, giving people gifts and wondering why I'm giving them these gifts and they're looking at me like, I don't want this. You know, well, all right, give it back. Don't hurt my feelings. I'll take it back to the store, get my money back, and go right to the liquor store. But I left that part out. And that's how things went. You know, ended up losing my job and having to move in with my parents. Me, my wife. Now, what's wrong with this picture? I'm the guy who's supposed to be setting the path for my brothers and sisters on how to live life. I'm doing pretty good, aren't I? You know, left home, went in the military, bombed out of that. Now I'm back home again. You know, I'm a great starter. I've started a lot of things, you know, started several careers, started a family, never finished none of it. The only thing I finished was my drinking career. Thank God. You know, and people, everybody around me kept saying, you know what, you have an issue. Do you see, you know, you hurting your mom. They used to tell me this stuff. My uncles would sit down. Now they're drunks. And I'm looking at them drunk telling me what I'm doing to my mom. So my answer was, what are you doing to your mom? Boy, don't you get smart with me. I'll knock you out. You got to catch me first. You know, that. Well, I don't get it, you know, and I'm wondering why the relationship in the home, I mean, I'm just tearing the home up. There are arguments going on behind closed doors that shouldn't be going on because of me. Because of me and the way I'm living my life. My sister has resented me so much that she called me everything but my name. You know, and my baby sister, to this day, still does not speak to me. The damages of alcoholism. I remember one time I took my son fishing. And we were out in Sheepshead Bay. If you know about the bay, it's ocean, a lot of water, more than you can drink. And I'm about half drunk. Fishing off the pier, catching nothing but cold ones. I bought my son a brand new pole. I'll never forget, it was gold. It was a beautiful pole. I mean, I admired that pole so much. The first time he went to cast it, he let it go, and it went. And instinct said, "Go get the pole." So I ran and I jumped off the pier. Now the only thing wrong with that picture is, I can't swim. Water, a lot of water, has a way of bringing, getting you sober real quick. Thank God for some older gentlemen on the pier who dragged my drunk behind out of that ocean, because, whoo. And I tell you that story because that's how I live my life. Those are the kind of decisions I made, you know. And I guess, and I say this in all seriousness, for whatever reason, this woman stuck with me for 15 years, and I put her through it, you know. Not only did I destroy her life, and I'm talking about, I've already damaged my parents, now I've moved on, see, because wherever you go, you will damage everything you touch. Now I'm damaging a beautiful young lady. I'm damaging children's lives who don't even deserve. Now I have a daughter, you know. Through all of the chaos, a daughter's born to me. I wasn't even there for her birth. I was away in some rehab, you know, because people were trying to help me. They were trying their best to help me, you know. And they would send me, and I would sit in these rooms and those old rehabs, you know. I didn't like it, first of all, because you had to wear those hospital gowns with the back out. And I always had the small one. And I'm looking at all these people in there who are older than me. I'm not looking at you, Joe. Older than me. And instead of trying to identify, I'm comparing. I'm listening to them talk. I'm like, I'm not as bad as you, because as far as I'm concerned, I got a job. I got a wife. I think I got one. Because the illness will keep you thinking that. It'll keep you stuck in denial, you know. But she stayed with me for 15 years. Why, I don't know. And the best thing that could have happened, I made a decision one day after another lie of I'm going to do it, and you know, those promises, and you know, I mean, I really meant it when I said it, because by this point, my son is crying, looking at me, asking me to daddy stop. My daughter's crying, daddy stop, and I'm looking at her, and I'm crying, and I'm meaning it at that time. I'm going to stop. But once that moment passes and you get back out there in the world and that obsession and that compulsion hits us alcoholics, it's a done deal. That frothy emotional appeal means nothing. So I came home one day after a relapse, and I took my ring off, I took my watch off, I took the keys off and left them in the house, and I walked away from my family, and I never looked back. I'm going to live my life the way I want to live it. You know, I believe today when I look at that situation, in order for me to be standing here, that's what needed to happen, because I would have continued to take them down. We had lost a couple of houses, and we were on the verge of losing the house that we had. You know, why is it that drunks manage to obtain good stuff and then just lose it? I mean, I don't even have a driver's license today as a result of my past, but back then, being drunk, I had a license, I had a CDL, a brand new truck sitting in the driveway, and I'm a drunk. Go figure. So I left them and I went on a run to end all runs, and I was talking to my girlfriend, and we were talking about prison, which is why I'm glad you guys are here. Because if you listen to me, you don't have to do what me and the gentleman who's going to follow me did. She said, "Boy, baby, one day is too much time for me." Well, I said, "Baby, try 3,650 days in prison." Because as a direct and indirect result of alcoholism, that's how much time I did. And for you math wizards, that's 10 years. Even then, I couldn't connect the two. It was her fault. It was his fault. They snitched me out. And the reality of it was, I met a little guy who ended up, no, I can't say that. Boy, you guys are really, he became real close to me. I'll just leave it at that. He had glasses. His name was Will. And as short as he was, he had forearms like Popeye. I always heard Dwight describe him. He was the only one in there man enough to tell me to my face, no matter how big I was, what I needed to hear. And what he said to me made me so mad I could have ran him through that brick wall on that weight pile. But you know what I realized in recovery? If you get mad, there's probably some truth to it. Because if it's a lie, you're not going to get mad. And he continued to address me like that. He wasn't intimidated by me, because I can be intimidating when I want to, except to my girlfriend. She intimidates me. And I got to ride home with this woman to sleep with her tonight. Can't come home, honey. No. But he began to show me myself. Because what God did was remove all the distractions. They removed all the excuses. They removed everything, because nobody wanted nothing to do with me. That's, you know, I come from a prominent family. My brother went into my baby brother, who they thought was going to be nothing. I was supposed to be something. My baby brother did 6 years in the Army, 2 tours in Iran, got his master's degree while he was in the military, and he works for the Pentagon right now. That's the one who wasn't going to be nothing. My two younger sisters, my one younger sister, she's a college professor at New York University. And my other sister, she's getting ready to start another career. She just came to visit me. She's got 2 degrees. She's going into housing authority, managing apartment complexes and stuff. Me, I work at a warehouse. And that's good. That's right where I need to be. And I don't deserve that. I need to say that. I don't deserve that. You know, one thing that I've come to realize about God, that he is merciful instead of justified, I guess is the word I'm looking for. He dishes out mercy, because I received a lot of grace and mercy. Those 10 years of my life were probably the longest years that I wouldn't wish that on nobody. You know, but that's what I needed. That's what it took for me to open my eyes, because I was a hard-headed alcoholic. You couldn't tell me nothing. I had my own agenda, and God nor man could pull me away from it. You know, every time you close the door, I'd open it right back up, by hook or by crook. That's the kind of drink I was. I was the guy that you always hear about, you know, the little joke going around, the guy who could sell you the bridge. That wasn't a joke. That's me, you know, back on my drinking. And I sold a few bridges, too. I guess I can say that now. The statute of limitations probably wore. But I'm just kidding. This is recorded. I found Alcoholics Anonymous in prison because of guys like you, because of my sponsor, who's probably been the greatest help in my life, you know. I remember sitting in the meetings in AA in prison in the back, just as antisocial, arms folded, screw facing people, you know, because we had to have that demeanor about us, you know. And that little guy, Will, was there and a few other people. And there was a guy at that particular time named Carter. I have to mention him because he's a big part of my life, too. Carter was another guy, you know. Wow. Next to Tom, he's the next walking big book I know. And when I say walking, I mean he lives the program. Been in prison almost 30 years with a life sentence. And no matter what happens in his life, he grabs that program. He drags sponsees out into that hot yard and he works with them. You know, and they're going to work with him because if you know Carter like I know him, when he says sit down and read the big book, you're going to sit down and read the big book. I got to go to the bathroom. No. He's not that bad. Used to be. But he taught me a lot. I remember taking and this is almost unheard of for any ex-cons in the room. Getting on your knees with another man in prison just doesn't sound right, you know. And I wasn't going to do it, but I did it. You know, and I remember what happened, but I know when I came up, something was different because I was crying and I hadn't cried in years, unless I was faking it to try to get some money. Some things began to happen, you know, and I began working with other alcoholics. I started in embracing this program, you know. I took it serious. Now, I watched Dean and the way he carries himself. You know, so I remember the first time I saw Dean, I know you guys hear this at every conference year after year, you know, but they used to have the guys, volunteers coming. I didn't know what volunteers were. And I remember sitting in a meeting one time and I seen Dean walk in. The first thought came to me. I said, man, what in the world did he do? He's got to come in here on the weekend or on the weekday in his street clothes and sitting here with us. You know, then he got up there and he announced himself. I'm like, man, he's high now. You know. That's just the way he talks. That's just the way he talks. Guess what? I want to talk like that one day because that has got to be the hardest work. I lived with that bear for over a year. Thank you, Dean. Because he took me in his home straight out of prison. Straight out of prison. And I lived with him. Yet I didn't. By that I mean I never saw him. I don't know when he sleeps to this day. He works and he goes to AA. He works. I have never seen the man miss a commitment except for family special occasions like his mom's birthday or his dad's something or somebody sick. Other than that, I could see him coming. Hey, man, how you doing? He'd be at the computer. Next thing I know, I'll catch you later. Where you going? I got to go to Wayne. I got to go to Wilmington. Okay, I'll see you tomorrow. I go on to Virginia. He stays on the go. I talk like that too. I'm talking like that now, running up about 8 hours of sleep. I don't know when the last time he had that many hours. He wouldn't know what to do with 8 hours of sleep. But God bless him because it's for guys like him and other people in this room that you open the doors for guys like me. You know, he allowed me to live my life. He's guided me. He still does. You know. I've since moved out, but in the process, let me wind this up real quick, because I want to be honest, I've lost all track of time. When you start talking about the family, you can't put time on that, you know, and like I said, listening to you, Joe, opened up a lot of, you know, I'm dealing with some emotions right now. Plus, I got some news not too long ago, you know, my girlfriend knows about it. I shared it with Dwight and Dean, my daughter, but it gives me a lot to be grateful for, too. Because I wasn't there for my daughter's prom. I don't know who her first boyfriend was. I know who he is now. But I remember listening to Dean real quick one day. I think I had been out about 6-8 months. I had been with you. And he came and he said, it's time. I said, what do you mean? He said, it's time to find your family. It's time to make those amends. He said, I don't know how to find them. He said, there's a wonderful thing that you've been missing all this time. It's called computers. And he showed me how to pull up some people finders, and bam, lo and behold, my brother's name comes up, and it shows a Florida address. So I wrote this address. Now I got to back up real, real quick. That baby sister I had, because I have two, the baby sister I had wrote me a letter while I was in prison and told me that mom and dad had died because of you. Don't write here no more. We want nothing to do with you. And she meant that. And I sent two more letters after that and they came back unopened. So I write this letter. We pray over it. He said, what are you going to do? I said, at this point, after all I've been through, I ain't got nothing to lose. I'm going to mail it. I mailed it, thought nothing else about it. I'm sitting in IHOP, Rocky Mount, and my phone rings, and I listen to the phone. I don't remember nothing after that because I think I dropped the phone in the eggs. I turned all kinds of shades. The waitress came running over. My girlfriend's freaking out, like, what's wrong with you? What's wrong? And I said, just everybody back up. I got to get air. I can't breathe. I felt like I was in that cell again. A split second, I went outside, and what that was a phone call from my mother. Now, here all these years, I'm thinking my mom was dead, because I took my sister and never lied to me before. So I thought, and I went outside, and I told my girlfriend, and she's like, you're kidding, you're lying, stop playing, that ain't funny. And I'm like, I'm dead serious, I'll listen to the recording. So I sat down, we prayed real quick, and I called her. And she was just like, I'm so glad you're alive. I got to say this real quick also. The reason that all of that transpired is when I started getting in trouble with the law and I got into some major trouble, my mom went behind my dad's back and took about $5,000 out of their retirement money to pay for a lawyer for me. And that, so again, the illness, once again, what it does to the family. So I talked to my mom. We drove back to the house. I talked to her some more. She said, look, I don't care what. You're still my son. I will always love you. And I'm so glad you're okay. And that just began to open up one door after the next. You know, because shortly after that, she told me that, well, you know, Olivia divorced you. I said, well, great. You know, that's good. She deserves to be happy. Really. She's remarried. I said, that's good. That's real good. She's living in Trenton, New Jersey. You know, David and Melanie are doing good. You know, David then grown up. He's went to school. He got his associates. Bing, bing, bing. All the good stuff that I missed. I'll pass on to Olivia that you called and let her make the decision. Later on, I found out that when she'd done that, Olivia, who is, God bless her, she's a devout Christian, she had years earlier had forgiven me. That was the only way she told me that she could move on with her life. And when she found out that I was alive, she immediately called the kids and said, I have something to tell you. Your father's alive, and we want you, it's up to you to call him. And it wasn't too shortly after that. Dean can remember the moments because I started getting phone calls that were blowing me away. You know, I think I've done more crying in the last couple of years being out of prison than I've done in the last, did I say I was 25? Yeah. See what I mean about that line? I'm 49. Soon to be 50, as my girlfriend reminds me. And that's opened up a lot of doors, you know, and allowed me to make amends. I have a beautiful relationship with my kids today. My son texted me the other day. He said, Dad, I'm just so glad we're looking forward to having fun this summer so we can make up for lost time. And I cut him off real quick. Son, I'm through with trying to make up for lost time. Let's live for today, and let's see what happens tomorrow. But right now, let's have fun today. I'm not trying to make up for lost time. I can't get those years back. I'm not going to try. That sister who separated everybody, I get a phone call about, I guess a month ago was. It's been a month. I'm at my girlfriend's house. It was her house at the time. Now it's our house. That's right, I said it. And it's my sister. She said, listen, I'm driving down to visit your brother, and we're coming to see you. Okay, you said that a couple of times. I didn't think nothing of it. So I told Kathy, she's like, yes, they're coming up. Wait. She freaks out every time she got to meet some family members because she's met my kids and fell in love with them, and that's a good thing. You know, I think she cried more than the kids when they came to visit me. Oh, I got away from that. They did come to see. They did come. Slow down, George. They did come to see me, and we had a wonderful reunion. And then my sister and my brother show up. You know, and that was another reunion. And that's just all of that is a direct result of Alcoholics Anonymous. And we're, you know, having people in my life like Dean, Dwight. I know I'm going to regret saying this. Even Michael J. And knowing Tom probably remembers me because he came to see me in prison. He had this big belt buckle. I'll never remember that. I said, I want that buckle, but they wouldn't let us have that in prison. You know, but it was guys like that and Steve, who isn't here or maybe is, and other people I've met since I've been out, Mark, Michelle. There's a lot of people that play a part in my life and they don't know it. Principals group, you guys have been wonderful. Probably the hardest thing I had to do was leave you guys, but I'm not gone. I'm going to show up like a wart when you least expect me and just annoy you, but it'll be in a good way. I don't know if my family will ever be 100% again, but I will say this. I think I have a better relationship now. You know why? Because the lies are gone, the alcoholism, the act of alcoholism. I still have the illness. I'm not going to get it twisted. It's gone. They ask me a question, I give them an answer. You know, I related to something that you said in your talk when you're talking about you're having such a wonderful time. My sister did that when she came to see me. We're having a great time, and I'm like, okay. And she brings up this stuff that happened like 15 years ago, and I'm like, just ruin it. Just ruin the visit. Well, I want an answer. My sister's demanding, and I had to give one because Kathy went to bed, and they came, and, you know, we came that time. And we did some serious talking, and she cried. And I never seen my sister cry, and that was a good thing. I'm sober today. I reach out and I try to help other people. I have a sponsor. I'm working. I'm in a relationship. That's another job and another talk for another type of meeting. But it's good. Because I can manage all that today. I feel I have emotions, and you know what? I have not, you know, by the grace of God, October, I'll be celebrating 10 years. I have not had a desire nor a thought to drink. And I've been hit with more bullets than I have time to tell you guys about, you know. But I thank you guys for what you're doing and letting you know, those of you who do it, you're not doing it in vain, because I'm just one of many. I know you're, the only thing you hear about on the news is the ones who fail, but there are a lot of success stories sitting out here. I'm looking at some of them, you know, and it's because of you guys coming in them prisons, bringing us hope. Because I was hopeless. And it took somebody like Dean to reach me. Little did I know, when that guy got up there wearing them bib coveralls and painter whites, that he would be my sponsor. Because I couldn't identify with him, but I do now. Not only is he my sponsor, he's my best friend. And with that being said, that's all I got.
My name is Dwight Collins, and I'm an alcoholic. My sobriety birth date is October the 30th, 2005. And I'm also a member of the Primary Purpose Group of Wilson. We meet on Mondays and Thursdays now from 7 to 8. Come and see us at the Raleigh Road Baptist Church. I had a method to my madness. I called Dean, I think Thursday, and he was getting the programs together. I said, let George go first. And so I got about 3 minutes. How much time do I got left? All right, that's cool. I want to thank Joe for chairing this meeting and filling in last year because I couldn't make it. I'll tell y'all in a few minutes why I wasn't here. And thank George for knocking out all that time. I'm a little bit nervous, man. About 20 minutes ago, I was calm. And then when I knew he was wrapping it up, man, I started getting a little nervous again. I don't think I was this nervous when I was sitting in front of that judge when he was talking about giving me all them years in the penitentiary. You know, Dean gave me a little pep talk right before I got up here, man. He said, don't worry about giving your story and qualifying. He's like, go straight to the point. This is something pretty serious. I'm going to qualify through talking about what I did to my family. You know, a lot of times in Alcoholics Anonymous meetings, you know, I hear people talk about, you know, they come from an alcoholic home. You know, George was just talking about his dad's liquor cabinet. I didn't have that. The only liquor in our house was on the top shelf in the cabinet, and it was a bottle of moonshine with some tinfoil over it. And it was for municipal purposes. I was raised in a church. I went to church every time the door was open, vacation Bible school, the whole nine yards, visitations, Wednesday nights, we was there. My parents raised me the best they could. I had two loving parents that stayed married until my dad passed away. You know, they was married for 33 years. They tried to teach me, you know, the principles that I try to live by today. As a result of my drinking, I started having consequences real early on. I can remember being 14 or 15 years old, and as a result of my alcoholism, me and my family's already going to counseling. Because I'm blaming Dad because he's out working all the time to buy me all this nice stuff I got, but he ain't spending no time with me. You know, it's all about me. And that's just the way it was. Put it bluntly, man, I put my parents and anybody that came in contact with me through absolute hell. The book talks about we make, you know, people neurotic. I did that tenfold. You know, talk about hearing Joe and George talk, man, I was just sitting here thinking back. Some of the looks my, you know, mom and dad gave me at some of the BS I would shoot them just to try to do what I do. I became a continuous drinker when I was about 13 years old. I became a daily drinker when I was probably 15. As a result of my alcoholism, when I was 17 years old, I graced the doors of that real nice place that BJ was talking about in Morganton, North Carolina, called a High Rise. I can remember going, I had chances before that. You know, I'd already got into trouble before I went to prison. They'd send me to mental health, and they got this question they ask you. Do you think your family would be embarrassed about you being incarcerated or getting locked up? No. You know, I mean, it never dawned on me that, and that's what I answered every time they asked me that question, because I went through that class a whole lot. I had a good lawyer. They would ask me that, and I'd be like, no. Because it was something common. You know, I had a cousin. I didn't have a drunk uncle. Most people got a drunk uncle. I had a drunk cousin. And that was my introduction to drinking, was him. He came to a Christmas party one time, and he had on, he's a redneck. My wife vouched for it. He had on a black leather trench coat, and it was Christmas, and it sounded like Jingle Bells. And he had 32 airplane bottles of Crown Royal in his pockets. And my grandma, she'd tell him, boy, it's going to kill you. But it didn't that day. He was having him a ball. But he was jingling. He was in the spirit. But that was, you know, pretty much my introduction to seeing, you know, somebody, you know, drinking and stuff like that. You know, my parents, you know, George talks about how his mom never gave up on him. My parents did everything they could to keep me from going where I went. They bought me everything I wanted. They did everything I wanted them to do. And in return, I was just 100% self-centered alcoholic. I didn't know that at the time. I didn't know I was an alcoholic. I thought I was a teenager doing what teenagers do. When I get old enough, I get into church like they are, and I'll be okay. God had other plans. I landed in the penitentiary at 17 years old. Real quick, you know, if this don't qualify, nothing will. I've been convicted of 4 felonies. I couldn't tell you how many misdemeanors. I've got 7 DUIs on my record, and I think that qualifies me enough as an alcoholic. Every one of those is related to alcohol. I've never had a ticket beyond a seatbelt and speeding ticket or any kind of charge where I wasn't drunk. I'm in prison, 17 years old, and all I want is my mama. I mean, that's it, man. My dad made sure I had my mama every Sunday. Now, this is how good my dad enabled me. When I was in the penitentiary, they give you some nice brown khaki pants that ain't stitched real good. And back in, you could have cash. And my dad would perfectly fold up a $20 bill every Sunday and give it to me. And I'd slip it right there so I could buy my cigarettes.
He'd do anything he could to make me happy. And that's what, I believe that's why I drank as long as I did, because I didn't have the consequences behind it. Sounds crazy, but even being in prison, it wasn't bad. I was like BJ. I found the ones that was doing what they was doing, and I gravitated. I fit right on in. It wasn't that bad, and that sounds absolutely stupid coming out my mouth right now. By then, you know, I done had three DUIs at 17. 3 o'clock in the morning, I'm calling mom and dad, come bail me out again. Both of them saying leave him in there, and then the other one talking the other one into coming and get me. And most of the time, it was my dad that would come get me, and he'd say it again. He'd pick me up. Boy, you just stupid. I wished he was still alive so I could say, nah, Daddy, I wasn't stupid. I was an alcoholic. But I wound up in prison at 17 years old on a 20-month sentence. And every visitation until they took him away from me, my parents was there. I never thought about what that did to them, the stress that that put on them. Not counting the money they spent. If I would have to pay back my parents the money they gave me, man, I could never do it. I got out of prison. I was going to try that plan BJ was talking about last night. I loved his talk, man. That was right up my alley. Beer, sell a little pot, we good to go. Worked out about a week and a half. It was right back to it. My dad owned a landscape company, and I'd worked for him off and on when he'd we had the contracts to mow cotton mills. Well, Daddy'd be like, I got you an interview. I'm like, all right. He's like, you need to get you some benefits and insurance. And that's what, I thought that's what he was trying to help me do, and he'd get me these good jobs, and he was just tired of dealing with me at work. And I don't blame him, man. He'd have to pay guys like an hour and a half to wait while he tried to get me out of the bed. And he would not leave until he got me out of the bed. And I can sit here and go on and on and on and on and on about some of the, sacrifices they made, to try to help me. I found out about 3 years ago that my mom and dad went to Al-Anon when I was 16 years old. I never knew that. My dad is an old country boy, so I'm sure he didn't stay too long. I had something, I used to steal money. I just didn't steal money. Dean's told me about hitting his daddy's stash and stuff before. I stole the whole checkbook one time. I was hood rich for about 3 weeks. If y'all don't know what that is, that means it's a lot of money real fast and it's gone real fast. I didn't think nothing about how they was going to have to pay for that. I thought overprotection was a plan that the bank covered their money. That ain't what it is. It just all started snowballing again, man. I completely destroyed every relationship I had with any family that I had. My brother, I got two older brothers. One's about George's age. He's old. he was by my dad's first marriage. Then I got one brother that's 4 years older than me. And me and him was pretty close coming up. I looked up to him. He was my role model. Then he met his wife when he was 16, and she stole him from me, so I hate her. She knew it, and she hated me too. Today we get along really well. But I broke into their house, not long after I got out of prison. I wasn't going to steal but small things either. Family's a lot less to press charges than other people. So that's what I did, I stole a bunch of guns from my brother, he still hadn't let me forget that. But I just destroyed those relationships. Just ripped them apart, man. Just took life out of everybody I come in contact with. Girlfriends, girlfriends, parents. I mean, it's unreal with the damage I've caused to the people I've been around because of alcoholism. You know, I was able to stick to some of these promises, you know, that I'm good at telling people, and I'm going to do different, and I'm going to quit drinking, and I'm going to pay bills and be responsible, and I could do that for a little while, and then, you know, hey, mama, can y'all come bail me out of jail? It ain't a fun feeling when you wake up from a blackout. I was in downtown Greensboro at a club. I come to in a little bitty room, and it ain't nobody around. It ain't no activity. Finally, about 6 hours into it, somebody walks by, and I knock on the door, and he looks in there, and he looks confused, and he's like, "What are you doing in there?" And I'm like, "I don't know." And they had forgot they put me down there. That's bad. They didn't know I was down there. And I got to looking around, and my knuckles are all scratched up, and I got grass stains on my pants. It ain't no grass downtown Greensboro. And, you know, I got out, went upstairs, and I called Daddy. You know, "Can you come pick me up? You know, lock me up again." "All right, I'll be out there in about an hour." And get in the truck, "Boy, you just stupid." And I believed that for a long time. But it just all kept happening and kept happening. I get in trouble, they bail me out. I get in trouble, they bail me out. In 2003, my dad passed away. And I had it together for a little while when that happened. I was still drinking, but just a bare minimum to get by. And when he passed away, they gave me the excuse to drink like I wanted to. And that's when it set in on my mom like it was no tomorrow. It was bad. Instead of letting my mom grieve my daddy's death, I tried my best to make her feel sorry for her baby boy. It's going to be hard for me to talk about the rest right now. I'm going to do my best. Y'all bear with me for a second. The next 2 years, I put my mom through absolute hell. She had me committed. Let me back up. I got married a month before my dad died. Lost my dad. 3 months later, I lost my father-in-law. 3 months after that, my wife got killed in a car wreck. So all that childhood faith I was brought up with the understanding of God at the time, went out the window. I did everything but put a gun in my mouth to try to kill myself in the next 2 years. And my mom sat there and watched it. And did what she could to try to keep me from doing those things. She had me committed in 2005 for the fear of her safety and my own. That's a direct result of alcoholism. Nobody's parents should have to feel that way about their son. I went to the detox, got out. About 4 months later, got a DUI on my birthday. My probation got violated a month before that. And the best idea I could come up with, because I had done tried to quit drinking that year a couple times, was to go to the penitentiary. I told my lawyer, I said, "Do what you got to do. Let's get a combined sentence and let's go to the penitentiary." That's one of those ideas that sounds real stupid right now. But at the time, I mean, that was the best idea I had. I had run out of options. I had tried AA when I was 17, and y'all was just a bunch of old white guys. Thanks, sir. And when I got as old as y'all were and I couldn't go to the club and do what I do, I'd be here too. I got here a lot earlier. But I wind up in the penitentiary, man, and I go through what they had then, was called a DART program. Ain't nothing I hadn't heard, man. I went through the DART program first time I was in a penitentiary. I've been going to counseling since I was 15 years old. I knew everything you want to know about alcoholism. I just want an alcoholic. I just had bad luck, man. They liked to catch me when it was bad. And, you know, I went through the motions of the penitentiary, and they sent me to Wayne. Hadn't never been to Wayne. Didn't want to go to Wayne. Didn't care nothing about Wayne. It was 3 hours away from home. I couldn't get no visits. Wasn't interested. Got there about 2 weeks in. They called AA. I walked in the meeting. Seen Dean sitting in there. When I walked in the meeting, a guy named Carter Downs greeted me. He said, "Hey, how you doing?" And he was smiling. Had no idea why this man was smiling. We in the penitentiary. Ain't nothing happy about none of this. And walked on in the room, and there's a bunch of other guys in there smiling. I think this big old dude over here was. And I thought, man, these guys in here ain't right, man. And I thought that, and then I seen a coffee pot, and I was like, they're happy because we got free coffee. And Carter read a statement after that meeting. It says, "If you need a sponsor, come see me." I didn't really know nothing about a sponsor at the time. I'm real big into racing. Sponsors, when you give me money to put your name of your company on the side of my car. I thought he was going to give me some money. And I went up to him. I said, "I need a sponsor." He says, "All right." And he called this big dude over. And he said, "This is Thomas." And I'm a pretty tall guy, man. I got to look at you. You're a real tall guy. And when he stuck his hand out, he had some lightning bolts, swastikas, some flames, and I was like, damn, you know. If you ever been to prison, you look at people and you say, "I wonder what he's in here for." You ain't had to do that with him. He had killed 2 or 3 people. And I was sure of it. And I didn't know about being a sponsor no more. But anyway, man, he had some stuff going on. He couldn't be a sponsor. And he a big old red-headed dude. And I went back to court. I said, "I need a sponsor. It ain't working out with Thomas." He's like, "All right." He said, "Tim, come here." Tim, red-headed too, man, but he wasn't about this tall. And I was like, "Something go down, I can take him." And they like giving you different color clothes when you do good in prison. He got his different color clothes and went to another camp. And I went to court. I said, "Man, I'm stuck, man. So I need a sponsor." He says, "Well, man, I'll do it." I said, "Cool deal." My life had already started changing. I wasn't asking mama for as much money. You know, when I first went to AA, I was like, "Mama, I'm an Alcoholics Anonymous. Doing great. Gonna stay out of prison. Can I get a money order?" And I was gradually getting better because I used to demand money in my account. You know, "You owed me that. I'm your son. I'm in prison. You know, feel sorry for me," even though I put myself there. But some things started changing, man. I stopped asking them to come see me. That was hard. When gas first started going up, and mama's help started going down. And she still took a phone call every week, and she sent me $15 every week. That was enough to get my cigarettes and a couple of soups to last me through the week. And she's still taking care of me. Long story short, man, God works in my life, man. Through Carter, my life changes. Come the time to get out of penitentiary, and I'm talking to my mom about going to, Wilson, and that's what she tells me. That's what I do. I wind up in Wilson, hit the ground running. As a result of Alcoholics Anonymous, you know, all those mended relationships, you know, I've been able to mend them. You know, my brother, about 3 years sober, I made my amends to him, and he looked at me. He said, "You a con man? You've always been a con man, and you always gonna be a con man." Today, he pretty much calls me on a daily basis. Me and my sister-in-law have told each other we love each other and embraced each other and meant it. And I'm going to sum this up right here. I'm not the same person I was when I come into Alcoholics Anonymous 6 years ago. My attitudes and outlooks have changed. And this is going to be real difficult right quick, and I'm going to wrap it up. Mike gave me the 5-minute sign. As a result of alcoholism, you know, Dean had asked me last year to come and give his talk. My mom had double pneumonia and was battling COPD for about 17 years. She had emphysema. She was in the hospital. It's a gift today. It's a year ago today that we buried her. I was supposed to give this talk last year. Instead, I was holding her hand when she took her last breath. It's sad, but at the same time, man, that's the most powerful thing Alcoholics Anonymous has gave me. I was there for her when she needed me. You know, today I'm able to be a husband. I got my own little Carter at home. I named my son after Carter. My life is more than what I thought it would ever be. I don't deserve nothing. On my own, I end up in the penitentiary. And it's where y'all got to come in and try to give me a little bit of the solution. Today, I'm able to be a volunteer at that prison I got sober in. And I never thought I'd be happy to see a guy light up when he sees me. But today I am, man. I can go to that penitentiary, man, and see those guys. And they're like, what's up, man? It's good seeing you. It's just amazing. I want to thank Dean for, you know, giving me the opportunity to get up here and do this again, you know. And once again, I want to thank Joe for filling in last year for me. And I want to thank George for taking up most of the time.
Thanks to George, we're going to have a 7-minute break.